Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. If you'd like to find more sessions, interviews, and story podcasts, visit our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. This podcast features a program session from the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference.
Well, good morning, you hearty souls. You know, Friday, last day of the conference, the East Coast melt, you know, those on the West Coast who have to make that flight back to the East, you guys are truly my heroes. Thanks for coming in, the first one at 8 o'clock in the morning. Usually I start out with a hilarious joke because it is my way, but in the interest of time, we only have 50 minutes, and quite frankly, we have a large amount of material to deliver, so I'm going to forgo the joke for now. If you need the joke, just come and see me afterwards, and I'll let you know what it was. There are three of us who are going to speak to you. We don't have anyone to introduce us, so please fill out the evaluation form online. EDUCAUSE appreciates that, as do we, because we always like to hear about how well we did. There are three of us here to talk about identity management, especially those who are the identity management associated with remote students. And while we went about going about how we went about doing that, there are three of us here to talk about it. I'm Mark McConaughey. I'm Senior Associate Registrar at Indiana University. I'm also the director of the ACRO Technology Conference. Leroy Rooker, the Prince of Privacy and Fiat to FERPA, is here to talk about compliance and regulatory matters associated with identity management. And last but not least is Ann West, Senior Program Director and Internet 2 representative. I don't know all of her. She has so many titles and lives so many places, it's hard to keep track of Ann. And we're all three here to talk about various aspects. Ann, I will actually do an introduction, talk about how the trends, the environment, the kinds of things that got us into talking about remote student identity. Leroy will talk about privacy and security matters associated with identity management practices and how FERPA applies. And last but not least, we've done a survey, as the title said, and we'll show you the results and conclusions of the survey, and that'll be Ann's part of the presentation. So first, and I've really just gone over that slide, so I'm going to move on. So what happened? About a year ago, as part of my role in ACRO Technology, we were hit with a question about what are reasonable practices associated with the distribution of credentials to prospects and suspects at the beginning of the student life cycle. And you think about that, it's a perfectly reasonable question. What's been reviewed? What does the higher ed community say, or what does the private world say about what are the best practices to use for the distribution of credentials in such a way that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy and security, that you've reasonably linked those set of credentials to a digital identity? And the truth is, as we thought about that, we couldn't answer the question. We ended up doing a webinar on it, but what we ended up doing was defining a set of practices, putting those out there as one way at least you could manage this. We had Lee take a look at that set of practices and say, you know, this is okay or it's not okay, and here are the kinds of things you need to worry about. But the truth is, we didn't know what set of practices there were out there. We didn't know what people did. We didn't know what the reasonable expectations were. And the question remains, when you identify somebody, when you've placed a record on your database for the purposes of contact, for the purposes of providing certain kinds of information services or completing or receiving information, what do you do? Are you sure you know who's on the other end of that set of credentials? We don't know. And so our goal was to come up with that set of practices that were reviewed and that we could put out as a template. So what kinds of things are we concerned about? Why does it matter? The feds matter. Regulation matters. Higher Educational Opportunity Act put in a provision that really stated that you must have a reasonable expectation, practice, that those who are taking tests are in fact the people you think they are. You have to have some practice in place that says, I really understand who that is. HIPAA, medical concerns, we want to protect the privacy of those kinds of concerns. GLB, financial matters, and of course, FERPA, which is why Lee is here. And, you know, these other things. I don't need to go through them in detail. I would say the federal government is working on trying to do some sort of unified federal identity credential management thing. Unsure exactly what that is, but it is rising in the world, in the space. We now do things so completely remotely that degrees can actually be awarded. You're setting up a lifetime credential, one that can be distributed once it's associated with an individual person. And in fact, if it's all happened remotely, you may have never seen that person face to face. How assured are you that you're actually giving that physical credential, that degree, to the real person? So now I need to set this. That's why we care. That's the environment we live in. But what are we really talking about in the world of student records, in the student life cycle? So I'm going to go through a set of slides here, and it'll start to indicate both how we deal with students at a higher ed institution and how identity management lays over the top of it. So information comes in. We make contact. We identify a suspect or prospect. We create a database record for them. Don't know much about it. We have certain attributes that we're maintaining, and we move on. We suddenly take that set of attributes and make contact with them in some form or fashion. We have a little bit more clarity, a little bit more focus about who that person is, but quite frankly, it's a little bit coincidental. We get a little more information. They sign up for an account. You go back and verify their address. You have a little bit more external coincidental evidence that they are who they say they are. In fact, they've given you a piece of information. You've used it. You went out and contacted them. It gives you some feeling that, in fact, something has occurred, that something is correct. You go and send them something about your institution. You verified their address. Now you have a little bit more information. They apply for financial aid. That's kind of a milestone mark. You know, we've kept a record. We have a little bit of external evidence that says this person is who they say they are. We haven't seen them. We haven't come through any other process. But now all of a sudden they've applied for financial aid. Now they may have done it through our campus. If they filled out a FAFSA, we now have external credibility. Some other source, another identity provider, comes in. We match some elements and we finally say, yeah, I'm starting to believe. I'm starting to believe this person. There's a preponderance of evidence building that says this person is who we think it is. And finally, we accept them. We get other pieces of information as a part of that admissions process. They actually pay. And now you've got various other kinds of tentacles of information focusing in on the single person. Very good, very good. And finally, they register for classes and they come. And they go to orientation. In a traditional world, finally, we get, although that isn't crystal clear, we finally get some focus about who this person is. Primarily because if they've come to campus, we put them through the orientation process, and we get an identity card and put them together with that physical person, we have now directly linked that physical person to the digital record. And that link is tied by the set of credentials that that person keeps with them and ties them to the digital record. So what did we just go through? Just so that we all work on the same terms, here are some of the terms that we're going to talk about through the rest of the session. Identity vetting. All of those times when you've taken specific attributes associated with students and you've used them to try and contact them or you validate them or verify them, or you have external credibility. You have a third party who comes in with certain information about the individual that matches what you already have. You're doing various kinds of identity vetting. Just as an aside, when we work at my institution, we almost always work with identity vetting until the student shows up on campus. An actual proof never occurs. It's a preponderance of evidence kind of proposal. Finally, identity proofing. I put them together. I've actually got some physical proof that this person is who they say they are, and I've tied them directly to the digital record. Identity mapping. You know, you've got to come up with that set of credentials, and you've got to tie it directly to the digital record. And we sometimes talk about loose and tight mapping. And the reason is that level of assurance you have about whether or not the individual is tied directly to that record. What's your level of assurance, in fact, that this person and that set of credentials is tied to this digital record? credentialing, I've already used it plenty, but you know what it is, passwords, network IDs, those things that basically say, I am who I say I am, it's private, only I have that specific bit of information, and when I do, I'm tied to that specific record. And last but not least, when I pass those tokens, those credentials off to a system, it identifies me and it authenticates me into the system. So here's another way of looking at it. Here's the student identity cycle. You know, suspects, prospects over here on the left, already registered and gone through orientation all the way on the right. The dotted black line indicates a point at which there's hard identity proofing, okay? And you can see in your certainty, you start off with, well, you know, and a lot of people mistake me for Robert Redford. You know, I could have entered this as Robert Redford. I go all the way across, and not until I really get to identity assured, while I'm standing in front of somebody, and somebody says, you know, you really aren't Robert Redford, do I know that I have mismatched those two pieces of information. Look at the boxes. First contact made. You know, that could have come in from test scores. It could have come in from a phone call, postcard, high school visits, various other means by which we could have first established that record on our database. An application received, more pieces of information. And in fact, at that point, we're starting to offer services back to the individual. Accepted and so on. And in the interest of time, I could take some examples from each one of those. But as you can see, as you move from left to right, common sense says that the kinds of information and service you're going to provide the student or that you might perchance disclose is going to get a little more severe, a little more vulnerable. Next. In thinking about the kinds of services that are offered to those individuals, Penn State did a great job here of basically doing something in three dimensions. Down the, you can't read it, and don't even try. Down the left-hand column are a set of services that are provisioned to individuals in their system. Across the top are basic categories of across the student life cycle. And in the middle, each one of those services is classified as low, medium, or high based upon the risk associated to the institution should those pieces of information or service be disclosed. As a result of doing that, you can see, and really, they also did former students, which is really beyond us at the moment, but take a look at this one right here. As you'd imagine, a student who's enrolled obviously has the highest risk kind of vulnerabilities associated with services that you can imagine. But I think the point here is look at this, a prospect. They're still red. Red is the highest risk category. Still red even for prospects and a little more for applicants. And yet, as you saw, move on. As you saw on this particular slide, our level of assurance about who that person is and what they're doing isn't what it ought to be. It's a preponderance of evidence, and our level of assurance on the left-hand side is not near what it is on the right-hand side. Notice, if you switch back and forth, key thing here, I think, is to determine where and how you want to do identity proofing of someone who is only coming in remotely. If you're going to move that identity proofing function to the left, how much is it going to cost the institution? The administrative overhead, the functional overhead, the keeping the database, adding them to the database, using up network IDs, all of those things come with a cost, and you worry about the return on the investment. On the other hand, you have to weigh that against the vulnerabilities you have with providing certain kinds of information and services which may not be compliant or deemed reasonable. In other words, you may, in fact, incur some liability for what you're offering because your level of assurance about putting together the physical person and the digital identity are not good. So that's what we were after. We chose, just to come all the way back, because this example sometimes includes a traditional student where you finally get the students on campus, we chose to do remote students because it so starkly separates from those and forces certain kinds of actions for identity proofing. So we chose to do the survey in that regard and to try and find those practices that are used to do identity proofing, those practices that are used for distribution of credentials. The one last thing to say, and really isn't indicated in these slides, is that the key component is when and how do you do identity proofing. The other pieces to remember, though, are over here on the left-hand side of that dotted arrow, what kind of practices are being used by the institution to distribute credentials. Are those practices reasonable, and can they be compromised? If they can be compromised, Lee may have something to say about our state of compliance with certain kinds of federal regulations. So with that, let me introduce Lee.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me back there? Okay, great. I'm going to briefly talk about the FERPA piece that we've got here just to follow on with what Mark was saying and to set the framework a bit for what needs to be there and what the salient issues are as far as FERPA is concerned. So when we talk about FERPA, we're talking about primary rights of students, which is what FERPA affords. This last one, the right to have some control over the disclosure of information from education records, will be the focus. As far as what, when we get into the authentication process, and that'll be what we'll get to as we talk about, though, FERPA, we talk about education records. This is a key definition in FERPA. Education records are those records that are directly related to the student and maintained by the institution or party acting for the institution. If it's not an education record, it's not subject to FERPA, and FERPA is not an issue, but it's a broad definition, and it includes the any personally identifiable information that's maintained on a student. And personally identifiable information includes things like the student's name, parents' names, address, those identifiers like a Social Security number, a student ID number. In the new regulations, the term biometric record was added and also defined. And the those new regulations, we also included things like indirect identifiers, date and place of birth, mother's maiden name, that sort of thing. And a record, which is, again, what we would talk about to be subject for, but a record means any information maintained in any way, includes but not limited to the items here, and in particular, computer media. Note that it includes handwriting and includes audio, video, microfilm, microfiche, but it specifically includes computer media. So those records that are electronically stored, shared, what have you, are all would be records as long as they are directly related to a student and are maintained. And a student means any individual is or has been in attendance at your institution and regarding whom the institution maintains records. So the question comes up, and it's an issue here because, as Mark was talking about, in all of the everything leading up to someone attending your institution, at what process or what point there in that process does that individual become a student in attendance? And what the issue has come up over the years at the department, what we said in response to that is you can pick the point at which a student or an applicant becomes a student at your institution. It can be as early as when you accept them. It can be as late as when they register for classes. And so it could be anywhere along that spectrum, as long as you have a reasonable basis for doing that and you apply it consistently. So for every student, this is the way it would work. Why is that important? Until they become a student, then the protections of FERPA don't apply. Now, as you think about that, though, so in terms of sharing information and that sort of thing, it's not a FERPA issue until they become a student. But as you're in the process of the application and what have you, and be very cautious that you are still authenticating the identity, because once they become a student, then you can only share, in many instances, information with the student or with the consent of the student. And so you want to make sure that your authentication prior to them becoming a student is sufficient to ensure that once they do, that they're who they say they are. A disclosure means to permit access to or the release, transfer, or other communication of information from education records by any means, including electronic here, and to any party. So that disclosure, it can be done, as it often is now, electronically, where records are shared or transferred electronically. It would be a disclosure, so in order for it to for you to disclose information, for an institution to do that, takes either a signed consent from the student that the student's provided that says it's okay to disclose my education records to this party for this purpose, or that it meets one of the exceptions to signed consent where you don't need that. But in terms of signed consent, one of the things we did in the regulations in 2004 is we added an electronic signature, that you could use accept an electronic signature for disclosing information from education records. We created a safe harbor in those regulations as well that said what you needed to do to identify and authenticate a particular person as the source of that electronic signature. So in there, that was the secret pin or password provided to that student for identifying them as the signer of a particular document. And I'll talk a bit more about authentication here in just a moment. But 9931 talks about the exceptions where you don't need a signed consent in order to disclose information, including to the student. You don't have to have a consent to provide something to the student. You do have to know it's the student, however. So it's back to this authentication piece that's there. FERPA generally requires that schools authenticate the identity of the requester, including the student, prior to disclosing that information from the student's records. And the new regulations address the identification and authentication. And this was something we put in the new regulations to help give direction to institutions as far as what you need to do to identify and authenticate an individual. Requirement is that you use reasonable methods to do that identity and authentication process, whether it's the parent or the student or other parties that are requesting access to information. Identification means that you're determining who the intended or authorized recipient is of the information, and authentication means that you're ensuring that the recipient is who he or she says it. And in the new regulations, we mention as far as what you can do and how you can authenticate secret pins or passwords, personal security questions, smart cards or tokens, those biometric indicators. That's where we defined that added biometric record into the new regulations also. Or other factors known or possessed only by the authorized recipient. So that was a key part in it, that if you're going to use something other than the more secure means of authenticating, has to be something that is known or possessed only by the individual to whom you're disclosing the information. So this means things like social security number, date of birth, mother's maiden name, those kinds of things are not considered reasonable under the regulations. So you can accept those, but you can't use them. It doesn't authenticate anything. It simply says this is the Social Security number, the date of birth, those sorts of things. But it doesn't tell you. Many different parties could have that information on a particular student. So what you can do is you have to go beyond that. And also we said that a single-factor authentication of identity may not provide reasonable protection for access to all types of records. So as you get into more sensitive information, having that more detailed authentication is going to be an important thing, because you've also got things like, and Mark touched on this, but GLB, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which all institutions, all post-secondary institutions, if you deal with any financial aid issues, you are going to be a financial institution under GLB. That means in addition to FERPA, you've also got to comply with the provisions of the GLB, which require even additional, have additional requirements beyond what FERPA requires, and that's because it's dealing with financial information, so it's protecting that that type of information. A couple of things that I put in here, one are resources for those additional questions that may come up, and then where you can go to look for that, both through the FPCO office and also through the at ACRO. We have a FERPA at acro.org where questions come to me, actually. So I'll see whatever you might send there. And also a website where you can get additional information. And then one other thing we now have available is the 2010 FERPA guide. ACRO 2010 FERPA guide has a lot of information in it, including discussions about the areas we're talking about today, and in particular as it relates to the new regulations that became effective in 2009. So, Ann, I'm going to turn it over to you. And
yes.
Yeah, and I might mention, too, just in reference to that, what we said in the regulations is that Social Security number and student ID numbers cannot be directory information. And then we went on to say on the student ID, unless the student ID number, it could be if it meets certain conditions. Those certain conditions would be that it doesn't do anything other than identify the student. Kind of like here's my email address. That says this is my email address, but it doesn't get you access to my emails. It doesn't, for the student ID number, and we took this off of and it's actually that letter in great detail is in the new ACRO FERPA guide, but it was it was an inquiry from University of Wisconsin at River Falls. They said, we've got this electronic system, and we need our student ID number to be to make it a directory item because it's that electronic identifier for all of our students. It doesn't do anything other than identify. So we analyzed that, went back in a lengthy discussion on it, said this is what you can do with this information. You can make it directory only if it, again, doesn't do anything else. Doesn't get you access to library books, doesn't get you a meal at the cafeteria, it doesn't get you access to other things. So if somebody has it, only thing it does is identify one person, nothing else. If it does anything else, then it can't be. But certainly you can make it that now under the new regulations. There's a lot of detail in this particular guide on that in more detail, and that letter's there also.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm going to go back, actually, to Mark's diagram just to talk about this for a bit and summarize a little bit what we've talked about so far. Leroy was mentioning that FERPA might be applied. You could basically indicate anywhere between accept and registration your declaration of a student. So that means that anywhere between that kind of, it looks like a red box on my screen, but is that middle kind of brownish box on the screen up there, which is accepted, and the far right, which is registered orientation, might be considered a student. So that whole aspect would be subject to FERPA. I think the other thing I want to just summarize before I go into my discussion of the survey is the identity vetting, the mapping, the credentialing. So what we're doing today then is information comes in, that's the identity vetting, and we're verifying it by sending email to the email address that was provided, by sending postal mail to the address that's being provided. And then we actually, in this particular case, looks like the credentialing, the issuing of the credentials, the user ID and password, is done in this particular instance at the application. And the loose mapping means that these credentials are loosely tied to the physical person. We really haven't done any of that tightly binding yet because we really, we haven't seen any picture ID, which is the identity proofing piece, right? We haven't done any of that tight binding yet. All we have is a person out there that says they're Ann West, and we have this body of information that we're collecting that's tagged Ann West, but we really don't know that the person who's out there that says that they're Ann West is really the person we're collecting information about. So that's what I mean by the loose mapping. It's really what Mark calls preponderance of evidence. So now, if they come to campus, for instance, or we want to do this tight binding under the deposit paid, which is where it says the identity assured, there has to be, and this doesn't have to be at the same process, it could be at different stages, somewhere someone has to show a physical ID to show that the physical person, right, is who they say they are. And then there has to be that tight binding to that information that you have on file for them. So that's really, when we're talking about identity proofing, we're talking about, for the purposes of the survey, that piece right there, which is the physical credentials, as well as then that tight binding. If you don't have that tight binding between the physical person and the electronic body of information, then really, who are you authenticating? You really don't know, frankly. So with that, let's go into the survey. So the Uncommon Federation and ACRO, which is the American Association of College Registrars and Admissions Officers, put together this survey on current practice. And in essence, what we're looking at is the not the technology, but the business processes. What are the actual business processes that we're using to do this whole credentialing piece? We wanted, as Mark said, to focus on distance education audiences because there is definitely something at stake there. We wanted to have a degree, academic credentials awarded at the end because we figured they might have tighter processes than folks who are doing maybe just ongoing adult education and things like that. So we sent this to, I believe, 2,000 ACRO institutional contacts, and the preliminary results that we have, again, this was just recently closed, reflect roughly 100 institutions. So what I'm going to show you is a few examples of the questions and the information that we received, and then we can talk through some of the conclusions. We haven't had a lot of time to do any analysis, so this is really, really preliminary, early stuff. So actually, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about what's going on here. So here's one of the first questions, question four in the survey. And again, what we do is we took that whole process, that student life cycle process, onboarding process really, and asked a number of questions associated with that process for the registrars and admissions officers. So we asked, when do you first learn about prospective students? And I guess one of the things that's kind of interesting, and I might... So at what point is the first login credential chosen or assigned? So one of the things we were looking at is the number of organizations have you actually apply for, like Penn State does, apply for Friends of Penn State account, and then when you actually are admitted, you get and arrive on campus, you get a PSU credential. So you get the access account, which is the hard credentials. So here we're asking about the first login credential. So what's kind of interesting, so this is for instance, you know, at if you have you probably have many more prospects than you actually do admitted folks, and then folks that actually, you know, pay their enrollment fee and actually come, right? So if you have thousands and thousands and thousands of prospects that never actually touch your institution, that never have a relationship with your institution, is there value in accepting credentials from other organizations like CollegeNet, right, or Google, and leveraging the account linking that those services may have to provide access into the prospect section of your recruiting process? Yeah. So I'll go on here. So for what purposes is this initial login credential used? As you can see, the big one would be financial aid, similar to what Mark and Leroy were talking about. If you're, if this person is accessing financial aid records before they've actually been identity proofed and that type mapping is done, then you really, you're having someone that you have some thought of who they are, but you don't have a type mapping. They're accessing financial aid. Yep. Well, if you look at that Penn State pie chart, they're accessing things like financial aid and financial aid information before they accept, right? So they might get an admit. They might be admitted. They have a financial aid package. They look at that, right? But they're not actually doing that type mapping until, in that particular instance, they come to campus. Now, we're talking all distance, right? So there's an issue there. Okay, so if the initial login credential is signed by a system, how do you communicate the credential to the remote person? The thing that's interesting here is number three, send via email to a prospect provided address. I would guess that that's probably not a really good idea in that you're sending your credentials, your user ID and password, to an email address off campus as opposed to using alternate ways. So I thought that was an interesting piece there. At what point is supporting documentation about an individual received from external third parties? What's interesting about this one is H, never. There are a number of people that don't receive anything from third parties, which I thought was, I mean, there are only a few, but there are a few out there, which I thought was kind of interesting. At what point do you perform primary identity proofing? Roughly 36%. And again, this is only roughly 25 folks because everyone did not fill out this question, say they don't do remote identity proofing. And then we talked a little bit about who's actually doing this. And so, you know, that's pretty common admissions. You would think that would be relatively high. Registrar, bursar, identity card. That one's actually interesting, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So for those who do identity proofing, what types of methods do they use? What do they require? So this is a kind of breakdown on the methods. What's interesting is video Skype. We asked that. We heard a number of campuses actually have folks show their picture ID and, you know, and their face on Skype as a way of doing identity proofing, which I thought was kind of interesting. And what other methods to use to prove the physical identity of the person? Now, this is interesting. So we had 25 folks say they don't do identity proofing and the rest do. So if you look at this, there's a pretty high percentage of folks that do in-person appearance on campus. But if you look at the other, the four on the bottom, other, these are very, they're using ministers, they're using military folks, things like that, which, so I guess they're outsourcing their identity proofing to the clergy, which I suppose that's a or the military, mentors, things like that. Mm-hmm.
What about foreign students? Were they included in the service?
They were. Right, right. They are still in this mix, and in fact, there was a comment on one of the final comments was, we don't do identity proofing on U.S. students, only foreign students. So we're kind of wondering about, well, what about the Timothy McVeigh syndrome? You know, how does that work? But, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would be surprised to the student, you're not going to do anything.
Yeah. I mean, the reason why we did this is we thought, well, folks would be more concerned about these people. And so they'd have tighter practices, and that's why we did this. But, yeah, you're absolutely right.
And the minute they come in that way, if they then completely separate, right?
But you know where that comes up, though, and I think Lee would back this up, is, so I do exactly that, do what you say, but then I create a transcript for them. You know, now, once they become a student, they come, I must comply with FERPA. Now the question is, how assured am I that I have tied this individual to this record? And I would suggest that in that case, it's not any better than asking the military or the clergy.
So these were a couple of comments that we just pulled out. And it just shows the problematic nature of this whole thing. And, you know, doing something beyond what we currently do would be extremely inconvenient for students and prospects. It would also be very labor-intensive. My concern is access allow parents, spouse, and significant others without completing the proper consent to disclose forms. I think we all get that. And then the other one I thought was really interesting is this information, and I think what they mean is collecting the information about the identity vetting, the identity proofing. This information is extremely confidential, just as Social Security information is. I'm not sure anyone should look at this data except for key representatives within an assigned admissions area. So they're pointing out that we're collecting even more kind of really sensitive PII stuff. So some preliminary conclusions, and we're still kind of sifting through this. You know, according to the folks who filled out the survey, roughly a third were not doing identity proofing. But as we kind of saw earlier, two-thirds say they are. But are they really? I mean, you know, accepting, in essence, letters from the clergy, the military, and other mentors and letters of reference is great for, again, collecting that body of knowledge. But it doesn't actually map that body of knowledge to the individual in any way at this point. So other thoughts? Question? Well, I think a lot of them just do a lot of schools that I've chatted with is it's more of a student giving access to someone else. It doesn't matter if it's a parent or a mentor or someone else. They give access to their academic records to someone else. So there's no vetting that's needed really in that case because the student is doing the permissions, granting their permission.
Again, with that, you go back to what FERPA says about the authentication. You've got to have some way, because they specifically in the regs and in the discussion, we talk about parents. And in the regs, we talk about that on authenticating whoever it is, that you have to be able to authenticate whatever that outside party is. So if they have consent to give it to the parent, somewhere you've got to in some way, it's not going to be the same level, for example, of the student. But
I'm not
Right, and that is a requirement, though, that you do that. I mean, that if a parent, if somebody calls up and says, I'm the parent, that's not authenticating. If they call up and give the Social Security number, that's not authenticating.
Right.
Or the date of birth, that doesn't authenticate anything. So it has to be beyond that in order to, and you can establish your parameters for that, but it needs to be something that is reasonable in authenticating that is the parent before you would give them information. If you can't authenticate it, don't give it to them, because you're not required to give it out. You are permitted to if you can authenticate.
So I just want to, I know there's a few questions. I just want to make sure that everybody knows it's a bit before 9, so we're definitely running over as we thought we might. But there are, we're happy to stay and chat further. So I'll just continue, and those who need to leave, please feel free to go. So there was a question here. Well, one of the questions we asked, which is really interesting, one of the questions we asked in the survey was, if this changes, you know, if you're going to change your processes, who's involved in that change? You know, and of course, given the folks we sent this out to, registrars and admission registrars in particular.
And you know how we are.
Yeah, you know how those folks are. I'm an IT background. But anyway, that was the longest bar was the registrar. But interestingly, IT was tiny. Pretty small. So I think some of it is how can we do this and still fit into the marketing and not make it onerous for the students and still streamline it for our own processes because it takes a lot of time. You might want to turn your name tag over given that Leroy's here. Yeah, I think you had your hand up. Mm-hmm. Well, and some of it is K-12 getting involved, right, and having the trust, because that's what we're talking about, the trust start possibly at K-12. So then we would accept the K-12 credentials and that way. And so they are vetted, I guess you could say, for 13 years through K-12. That's right. Or face to face, that's right.
Right.
That's true.
That's right. That's
correct. That's
true.
Yeah.
My institution, I'm more involved in how are they authenticating. I'm more from tracing the red flags, realizing you're doing what? No. You know, and telling people, adjust this, adjust that. Maybe
right.
Simple
so no. So that,
hey,
that's a really good point. So Leroy kind of represents the privacy aspect of the question. But there's the security aspect of the question, too. And the security hits, I mean, FERPA might not start until a little bit later in the process, but security starts from day one. So, yeah, that's a good point.
One of the things, let me just follow up on your first comment there, but one of the things that came out of the Acro Technology Conference a couple of years ago dealt with, again, it was on a lot of distance learning and authentication, but and I don't remember if it's Arizona State or the authentication for them, the thing they did is to require that the applicant provide a copy of a driver's license that's been with a
notary.
Sent in so that somebody has identified that person, that driver's license of this person, and said, yes, this is this person and this driver's license go together. And so it gives you a much greater sense of authentication at that point that that's, you know, you're dealing with the student.
But I think I'm going to.
Yeah, but a notary is legally, it's a legally accepted authentication mechanism.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if we can do much better than.
Yeah, and the other thing I.
No, you can choose a notary.
Yeah. You know, the other thing to say The other thing to say, and I think you're getting at kind of what we were after in the survey, you in essence said, and I think I would play right into Anne's hands here for In Common, you really talked about who can be a good identity provider for us as we establish our digital records at each of our institutions. Now, if I've already established an identity and I have some trust about their ability to establish the identity, in other words, I trust that they've met a specific identity threshold, then I can trust them as an identity provider. And then if I have a set of standards where we can transfer the information back and forth, I can now say, I have Robert Redford, and I can take Robert Redford from NYU, and I have some confidence that when they log in with the set of credentials that they've established at NYU, and I have some trust that they've met that set of minimum threshold standards in establishing that identity, I now am in good shape. And therefore, my ability to award a degree and to provide certain kinds of information and service is good. And so I think that's what we're trying to get at, is with knowing what kind of practices are out there, particularly for doing remote identity proofing and authentication and vetting, we can establish a set of practices that will play into establishing that set of standards. Am I off base?
Yeah, I don't think so. And I think one of the things we'd like to do is follow up with those folks that use some of these different notary practices and other, you know, the documents. How do they give us a little idea that the kind of the process description of what you do and how many folks, frankly, that you process every year? I mean, that's one of the questions we ask too. So we need to kind of dive a little bit deeper into that information.
And one last quick comment. We'll take other questions, but all of that doesn't address well the international question. I mean, that's a whole different animal.
That's very true.
Now, I'm going to speak for Anne here. She's going to walk out on us. We're used to that, but she actually this time it's for a legitimate reason. She has a plane to catch and is therefore going to leave. However, Lee and I, we have nothing to do with our lives. So we'll still be here if you want to continue the discussion.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.